Well, that's all. So many of you probably heard that there have been prophecies around for a long time stating that when the age becomes very, very degenerate, we're really hitting the bottom of the trough, degenerate in all the five different ways, that will be a time when Dzogchen is especially effective, really powerful, and really powerfully transformative. It's been around for a long time, prophecy. And it does actually make very intuitive sense to me, really good sense. Because so if we sense, and I think you do already, you sense the mood, the ambience, the feel of the Dzogchen altogether, the view, the meditation, the conduct, you know of it. So I think I need to synopsize it. But just, well, very briefly, just the whole theme of relax, of release, of relaxation, of releasing effort, and discovering what's already there, you know, in the gentlest of ways, and then receiving simply the blessings from one's own pristine awareness flowing out, you know, there's the mood of it. And if we think about the kind of more generic, because clearly many people have different worldviews nowadays, but the worldviews, the amalgam, the kind of the alloy of the worldview of modernity, which is clearly not that of Islam, for example. It's a different worldview. And Orthodox Judaism, that's a different worldview, and so on. But there is something generic that you can find now all over the place. And so the worldview, what is considered to be normal in modernity, and we find it in the media all over the place, right? And we know that although materialism is not, how do you say, completely uniform, it certainly bears a very strong influence. And so the triad of materialism as a worldview, hedonism, the pursuit of the hedonic, I don't mean something crude, that can include music and literature and art. There's nothing wrong with those at all, but it is stimulus-driven and it is looking outside. So hedonism can be very beautiful, but it is still hedonism. And then consumerism, that the good life is to be found by consuming, and the better life is found by consuming more. That whole triad of materialism, hedonism, consumerism, it is now obviously very prevalent worldwide. And I can hardly think of a worldview, set of values, and way of life that is more diametrically opposed to or different from that of Dzogchen. It's hard to imagine. I haven't come up with it. And so we're tilting so far in this direction now, so much so that we are destroying our own planet and imperiling our own civilization while wiping out so much of the wildlife on the planet. 40% in the last 50 years. Yeah, so right here, 40% in the last 50 years. In other words, the greatest die-off of species since the meteor hit 65 million years ago, and we've done that in 50 years. So this is pretty intense, and I cannot avoid the conclusion that it has to do with our worldview, way of life, and, you know, values. And so we see Dzogchen coming within the wide bandwidth. I mean, there are really many sub-world views within Buddhism. Theravada is very different from Mahayana in some significant respects. And within Mahayana and within the four different philosophical schools and so forth. But we come to Dzogchen and we say, that's about as different from modernity as possible. And it balances. It balances, you know. And so today we come in the text in this spiritual autobiographical sketch, I think we can say, because it's so brief and to the point. We come to this point where he's been resting in the luminosity and cognizance and having these really quite extraordinary nyam arising one after another, each one a bit different from the other. And then, as we'll see, when we get right back to the text, and then he had his breakthrough. He just cuts right through the conditioned mind. And then he's describing, as much as words can articulate, he's describing his experience of resting in Rigpa, right? And so that's what we'll do for our practice here. But it's highlighting here something that is widely stated and can only be emphasized more, and that is Dzogchen is not simply a type of meditation. It is really a worldview, a meditation, and a whole way of life. Da, gong, chi, hu, meditation, and conduct. And the three are all mutually interdependent. So as we find this in multiple other contexts, the known, the knowing, and the knower, for example, take away one and the other two vanish, right? So we've been through that, I think, a number of times. But it shows that within the triad of the knower, the knowing, and that which is known, none of those three can be inherently existent. If by the removal of one, the other two go poof, just vanish, without even touching them, right? If I should do something really violent, like going boink like that, and push Anila over, the two of you don't fall over, right? If I go boink and you fall, put you over, you don't fall over. So in a way, you have your own autonomy there, right? But in terms of knower, knowing, and known, you go boink and the other two go boink. You know, they're so profoundly interrelated. Take away one, the other two simply vanish, which means they cannot possibly be inherently existent. They have to be existing in mutual interdependence. And likewise, there is no such thing as the view without meditation and conduct. Dzogchen meditation without the conduct and view. Dzogchen conduct, way of life, without the meditation and view. Take away one, the other one just vanish. They're gone, right? And as is said so often, that Dzogchen meditation is nothing other than sustaining the view. You access the view and then you simply dwell in the view, and Dzogchen meditation is nothing more or less than that. The texture, the abiding, the Dzogchen meditation of abiding in Rigpa. So if we think again, since this Rigpa is already here, this extraordinary statement that our nature is we are already Buddhas, it's there but obviously not in plain sight, that is, we're not seeing it. I try not to be too repetitive here, but we come back to the all-important question. And the question is not what can we do to achieve vidyadharahood, but what can we remove so that which is already there becomes evident. And we can fully enjoy it, one can say. Enjoy it, you know. And so we've been through that before with the five obscurations and so forth. But just taking a step further back from there, these outer preliminaries, they are there because they don't come naturally, and our worldview is probably going to be whatever one is, not just a materialist, a lot of other people who are not materialists will probably be just the opposite. Having a view of our own existence which is not one of this is a precious human birth, unbelievably precious and rare, full of potential. I don't think many people think that, right? And then the second one, and then in terms of death and impermanence, in terms of karma, the nature of suffering. It's not just learning to believe those, it's that we are habituated to the contrary. And that will block us. That will block us. We'll never develop that escape velocity, that momentum, if we take our own life for granted and kind of assume, yeah, death is for other people or, you know, a long time from now. And really not even a matter of concern because I'm really doing well now, my health is good, and it's really a beautiful day. How could death possibly touch this? You know, really, this is so stable, it's so real, it's so, this is our place. I'm going to make my home here. You know, that settling in as if things are going to abide as they are. The notion that our actions have no consequences unless somebody else finds out. And the notion that samsara can be pretty pleasant. You just have to be clever. You just have to be clever. And the smart people are really, really happy because they've got it figured out. You know, they got the combinations. It's very easy to think that. And if that's where you're living, that will completely. It doesn't matter whether you practice Dzogchen meditation. You can practice for 10,000 hours. It's not going to cut it. And likewise, viewing the guru is simply a good person, very informative, very helpful, good guy, good woman. Yeah, very informative. Yeah, almost as good as Google. No, not quite as easy to use, but nevertheless. And the Dharma friends, you know, they're kind of yucky, frankly. And the sentient beings out there, they're pretty pathetic. I mean, they really do awful things. I really don't like them much. You know, that view, that'll block you. Go ahead and jump into Dzogchen and meditation and all of that. It'll block you. It'll be like a rat in a maze. Oh, I'm really getting someplace. And so that's why those are there. It's not that we have to become, you know, indoctrinated or learn this, adopt this belief, but we're doing the contrary and that will block us, right? And then there's those five obscurations. That's where shamatha comes in. And then there's, because if they cloud over, then even if we get a glimpse, it'll be immediately, the clouds will come over and cover it again. And then there's realization of emptiness, of our own minds, crucially, but also of all other phenomena. And insofar as we're still reifying, which is a deeply ingrained habit, you know, as long as we're reifying, even if we get a little glimpse, the clouds will come right over, reification will set in, and reification and realization of Rigpa cannot possibly occur in the same mind stream at the same time, right? And so that's why we simply have to remove all these veils, the veils of, you know, just taking our lives for granted and so forth through the outer, the inner preliminaries, remove the veils of the five obscurations by letting awareness come and rest in its natural state. And once there, remove the veils of grasping onto, reifying all kinds of phenomena. Remove all of those, and then you're ready, really ready, to have the Dzogchen view pointed out to you. And then you're really ready to go into Dzogchen meditation. So that's what we're about to do here. It's the non-meditation. It's the kind of the grand finale in this little sequence. But a couple of points, and I think I can be brief here, are really, really crucial. Because people can study Dzogchen for years. You can get a PhD in Dzogchen. You know, you can become a Kenpo in Dzogchen. You can study all the seven works and all the Guhyagarbha Tantra and the multiple commentaries. And you know, you could spend a whole life just studying Dzogchen. I mean, there's a wealth of literature there. Commentaries, sub-commentaries, and so forth. But if all that study is not connected to your meditation, then it gives you a lot of good seeds, I guess, a lot of good imprints. But the whole point of that, of the learning, which we're doing right here, but we're doing it quintessentially, and that's why I've been taught. I was never really taught one scholarly treatise on Dzogchen, not even one. And I didn't, frankly, to be very candid, I never really wanted to. Because I did the scholarly stuff for 20 years. And when I was first being introduced to Dzogchen, I was getting a PhD at Stanford, and there was a lot of scholarly stuff with that. So the last thing I wanted from Gyatro Rinpoche is, oh, Alan, you're a good scholar, good. I got a ton of stuff for you. You know, he didn't. It was just one practice, quintessential text after another, all only about practice. And one by one, all only about the path. Always coming to the path. This is the way Gyatro Rinpoche guided me. And for that, I don't know if I can say I'm infinitely grateful, but closest approximation to that, because it was all just for the practice, period. And that's all I have to share, just what I've received. And so we are introduced to the view. It can be elaborately or it can be concisely. And first there arises the understanding from hearing, and then we check it out. Nobody's asking for blind faith anywhere here, but we're not just using intellect. That's what I sensed when I picked up my first book on Tibetan Buddhism, the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation, right? The first one, Evans Wentz, it was already out there in 1970 when I started. And it's hard to remember what you knew and didn't know 47 years ago. But I have a pretty clear sense that I knew I didn't understand it. And I also knew, I had a very powerful sense, this is it. This is it. This is it. I found what I was looking for, which means I couldn't see it, of course. It's not perceptual. It's not inferential. It was not powerful logic. It was not philosophy. It was just flat-out intuition. So that counts. When we're assessing, reflecting upon, trying to understand the teachings, going into them, returning to them, contemplating them, we do use whatever powers of perception that can be relevant, for sure. That is, as you're observing your own mind, as observing consciousness, that's perception. We will use our power of prajna, of intelligence, transforming into wisdom. For sure we use that. But we're also very explicitly using that third one, jnana, primordial consciousness, which in ordinary terminology, I'd say, is pretty close to intuition. And it's more, and some of you have experienced that quite explicitly. Maybe many of you have, I don't know. We haven't had so many conversations yet. But there's clearly a difference between intuition as a mode of knowing as versus simply having a hunch or a guess or kind of a feeling and so forth. It is a type of knowing that you cannot say, it's not that I saw it and not that I figured it out rationally. I know it at a deeper level. And I think that's what I must have been experiencing when I was hitchhiking around Europe and reading the Tibetan Book of the Great Liberation. it was just something deeper, deeper than merely observation or, you know, logic. And so the point here being that we warm up by listening to teachings, and from that getting an understanding of the teachings themselves, and then we reflect upon them, contemplate, investigate, including using intuition, and going back and forth between practice, meditating, and then coming out to the view, meditating and reflecting upon the view, and to the point that greater and greater certainty, greater and greater confidence arises. So, the understanding from reflection, and then with that basis, then we slip into meditation, and another whole dimension of understanding, of knowing, of insight arises. So a final point before Jamben, and it's very simple, it's familiar, so I think I can be brief, but it's really, really important. And that is, let's keep to a very simple practice that has no more color to it than water. And that is mindfully breathing in, mindfully breathing out. There's nothing in the nature of that action from breath to breath to breath that guarantees it's going to be virtuous. It could be completely neutral. I just kind of like doing it, or I'm bored, I have nothing else to do, so I guess I'll just do that. Or you could be kind of prepping yourself for some really terrible act, but wanting to do it very calm and very focused. You know, could. Right? Why not? I don't even give an example. And then every breath you're breathing in, breathing out, is a preparation to engage in some terrible, terrible act that could be terribly harmful to many people. Could be. So we see that simple practice can be just ethically neutral. I'm just doing it for stress reduction, or I have nothing else, I'm bored. Or it could be motivated by bodhicitta. It could be motivated by renunciation, which is then setting off in the path of liberation. It could be motivated by bodhicitta. Now it's a bodhisattva act. It's engaged bodhicitta. Every breath you're breathing in and out is taking you towards the path of the bodhisattva. It could be something really viable where every breath you're taking in and out, because of your intention, you could be breathing out, and with every in-breath, out-breath, you could be accruing negative karma. Okay? I've often given the example of being in your basement and building explosives, some explosive device. And it could be for fireworks display on, you know, like Independence Day, and it's just a lot of fun, ethically neutral. And boom, 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 everybody enjoys, and, you know, happy days. But it's ethically neutral. It could be for doing, obviously, a terrorist act in which every moment there, every screw, every wire you connect, everything you're doing, every movement is a negative act. Everyone is storing terrible, terrible imprints in your mind because of what you plan to do with that. Whether or not you succeed, right? Even if you never get to fulfill it, and somebody, the cops come, put you in jail for 10 years, you still have that negative karma. Even though you didn't harm anybody, the intention was there, you were planning it, you just didn't come to culmination. And then, of course, as I've often given the example, you could be building these explosives to build a tunnel between two villages so that they can have communication. It would be a great blessing to both communities. So, you know, then it's complete virtue. It's an act of altruism, doing exactly the same thing. That's the point. And so here, when we come to the non-meditation, of course, that's basically the title of the next book we'll look into, Buddhahood Without Meditation, Buddhahood with no non-meditation, then, like mindfulness of breathing, you could be sitting there doing nothing. Does that guarantee you're practicing Dzogchen? Or could you just be accruing the karma of becoming a marmot? To take my, you know, favorite example, just, that's my meditation, you know. And it's fine, you're just sitting there. That's fine, but let's not quit ourselves. That isolated from view and contact, that's not Dzogchen, it's not Dharma, it's just sitting there like a marmot, right? And so if you're practicing non-doing, and that's where we're going very quickly, then if the motivation for that, which you make explicit, it is, and that actually that which arouses you, motivates you, and sustains you in the practice. Why don't you quit? Why did you start? And you don't have to talk about it, but if the reason is, it's bodhicitta. That's why I started. That's why I studied before. That's why I started. And that's why I'm continuing. And that's why I'm going into retreat. It's bodhicitta. Then every moment they're sitting there not doing anything at all, sublime virtue. Because it's imbued with bodhicitta. And bear in mind, as you're sitting there doing nothing at all, in the not doing, you're not thinking, all sentient beings, I hope this really helps. I hope I achieve enlightenment quickly. There's no commentary. you're not bringing anything to kind of rev up the juices. We're good. You know, shut up. We're good. We're holding you. The bodhicitta is there. You don't need to talk about it. It's there. Just like the person who's building a bomb to blow up people doesn't have to keep on thinking angry thoughts. They might have a very cool, very cold, or just very clinical, or just sheer expertise. This is such an ingenious bomb. It's amazing. And that may be the mindset that's carrying through. And underlying it, I want to kill as many people as I can. But you don't have to keep on having malevolent thoughts the whole time. That's just what's sustaining you. It got you started. That's what's sustaining you until you finish it. Every moment is just sending you into realms you would never want to visit. You know, all motivation. So the motivation there, really crucial. And bodhicitta is the only one that's suitable. But here's the final point, and that is, you don't start Dzogchen meditation without having heard anything about the view, because it's impossible in principle. Dzogchen meditation is simply sustaining the view. Sustaining the view is not holding a belief. It is as I'm viewing, attending to, beholding from the perspective of Rigpa. And that's what it is. And so as you, whatever understanding from hearing and contemplation you've acquired through studying, learning, reflecting, then when you carry that with you, and your practice is imbued with whatever understanding you have. You're not thinking about it. You're not commenting. You're not messing it up any more than you're thinking, you know, sentient beings, don't worry, I'm coming. You know, you're just doing the practice. But it's imbued then both with the skillful means and the wisdom. That's really crucial, right? And then you come out of meditation, and if you want to see this come to its fulfillment, then, as I think it was Dujun Rinpoche said in one of his texts, when you come out slowly. You don't you don't jerk yourself out of the meditation. You come out slowly, and then as you then walk or do whatever you're doing, there's that smooth coming out, and then just the flowing of whatever view was there. You're now bringing that out into the world. So the smoothness in an ongoing continuity, not the same as if you're simply sitting in meditation, because your body's in motion and so forth, but you see it's flavored. You're flavored, right? And so the conduct is imbued with the view and the meditation. And you know what I'm going to say. The view is imbued with conduct and meditation. The meditation is imbued with the view and conduct. They all filter together. Each one is separate. Just like the knower, the knowing, and the known, they're not the same. But they're independent. So I think that's maybe enough. But the context is enormously important. And it's a package deal. Materialism, hedonism, consumerism, it's a package deal. They really support each other. They reinforce each other really strongly. And I want to emphasize, and there are very virtuous people, fine people, ethical people, who maintain a materialistic worldview. I have no doubt about that. I think I've never doubted that. They can be very, very good. Philanthropists and so forth and so on. So to say that the value system is hedonic, that doesn't mean selfish. It just means when they think of doing something good in the world, they think of doing something hedonically good. And there's certainly nothing wrong with that. That's kind of like building hospitals and schools and literature and arts and so forth and so on. So I'm not being pejorative. It's just that these people will never get around to going inside because there's no motivation. And the way of life will be consumer driven. That doesn't mean you have to be greedy and gluttonous and all of that. It just means that that's how you find the good life. And that's how you enjoy the good life, by consuming. And we see the great economies of the world, like China, I just read this morning. They're right on the right track. We know why? Because it's 6.9 growth of GDP recently. That's intrinsically a good thing, isn't it? Why does anybody think that? It's crazy. If it's intrinsically a good thing, then all of the countries should wish they had 6.9. Which means we'll just suck the earth dry faster. And that the fact that this is not on the lips of all of the big politicians and economists, I don't understand it. Sometimes I really feel like I'm living in an insane asylum. To think this is going to turn out well. With the global warming, the depletion, the emptying of the oceans of fish, the depletion of natural resources, the wiping out of other species, and then let alone all the weapons that are just waiting to be used. Thinking this is going to turn out well is really quite idiotic. So, in the face of intense idiocy, we have the intense clarity of Dzogchen. It's radiant. And it's good all the way through. It's Samantabhadra. Samantabhadra, totally. Bhadra, good. It really is. I think it's obvious. It's totally good. There are no losers in Dzogchen. It's all-encompassing. It makes sense of all the different worldviews. And it looks upon all sentient beings, as does Mahayana Dharma in general, but it looks with all sentient beings we know as our family. As our family. All to be viewed with compassion. That is the only Dzogchen way of viewing other sentient beings. Right? So there's no dark side. No dark side to it at all. Clear light all the way through. Hola, so. So, I'll see if I can make myself comfy on my new nest. Please find a comfortable position. And we'll try to follow in the footsteps of Dujom Limba. So I trust by now you have a clear understanding of the various differences between mindfulness of breathing and these different nuances, the different approaches. So it's mindfulness of breathing, there's one category. And then there's the practice of settling the mind into its natural state, quite different practice, some common ground, but very distinctive features. And there's shamatha without a sign, not the same as settling the mind, quite distinctive. That you see each of these very clearly, the differences between each of the three. It's important. And then we have this. And so then is a very good question. What's the difference between this practice of non-meditation or Dzogchen meditation and shamatha without a sign? And I know the answer because I've asked a person who really knows, the great Vidyadhara, Yantana Bhuche. And he stated, the difference between is, I'm paraphrasing here, because there are two things coming to mind, I'll say them both, and I can't remember everything exactly which Lama said, but I'm quite confident what I'm about to say is true. And that is the difference between shamatha without a sign and Dzogchen meditation is, shamatha without a sign is not imbued with the Dzogchen view. And Dzogchen meditation is, because it's simply sustaining that view. So whether those are the exact words, I know those words are true. Another way of saying this, it's not quite the same thing, but it's in the same family, is that shamatha without a sign is imbued still involuntarily, but it's imbued with grasping. Very subtle grasping, but grasping is there, right? Resting in the view, in chokshat, just letting be, just this open presence of awareness, it's free of grasping. So that's a crucial point. It's subtle, but it's quite clear. And somebody just recently quoted to me a lovely, pithy instruction from Kandrala, who's one of my lamas. Zina dungal, rwa? Zina dunga. Who told me that? Zina dunga. Kirabe. Zina dukha. Zina dunga. If grasping is really pithy, zina, if grasping, dunga. Dukha. Madzina, de. Dewa, yeah. I abbreviated it. Madzina, dewa. If no grasping, bliss. I think we're finished here. That's pretty much, that's the seed. The whole tree will come out of that, right? So lovely. Thank you, Patrice, for sharing that with me from one of my revered gurus, who is just like a fountain of just spontaneous, self-emergent, just wondrous wisdom. I had just 1 hour just listening to her. And, oh, so inspiring. See that just flow, and it was utterly contemporary. That's what really got me. It was primordial. It was just pure Dzogchen from my perspective. It was so contemporary, so attentive to the current reality, what's happening in our world today, and so utterly primordial. It's quite remarkable. So if you have the opportunity to be in her presence, Kanula, to receive teaching from her, simply to experience her, it's a transformative experience. Be in the midst of such purity is quite extraordinary. Hola, so. So we return. This was a real cliffhanger, in case you weren't aware. And that is, he's just shared with us here on page 149, that central paragraph. So candidly and very succinctly, very clearly, shared with us some of the nyama he was experiencing while he ardently meditated on luminosity and cognizance. Even I'm quite confident that's a fine translation. It's okay, but again, when we say meditated on, it sounds like you're looking at something and focusing on it. But of course, you're not saying, there's a nice chunk of luminosity, or oh yeah, there's cognizance. I've got that. Of course, it can't be that way. So it's this self-illuminating luminosity. It's this self-knowing cognizance. It's being the stream rather than sitting on the bank and looking at it, right? It's that type of intimate immersion in, dwelling in the luminosity and cognizance from which arose these very, very meaningful nyam, or meditative experiences. But he concluded, and I repeat this last sentence, I knew that these experiences, these nyam, were attributable to grasping at the ground of being as an object. Still there was that sense. And you may, if you can discern this in your own experience, that'd be very, very helpful. When you're practicing just resting in luminosity and cognizance, you're practicing shamatha without a sign, you're doing it correctly, you're right on the spot, you know you're doing it correctly, see if there's not a strain, an element of attending to awareness as an object. What are you attending to? Awareness. I'm doing it right. I'm sure I'm doing it right. That's exactly this ground of being. Ground of being, of course, is awareness. It's awareness that is the ground awareness. It's Buddha nature. And we're grasping to it as awareness, and that itself, that bifurcation of subject-object, that's exactly what's holding us back. And then he was able to relax, to release that grasping. And then he simply says, then, and he doesn't say what was the exact catalyst for it, and so he just simply doesn't say it. There's no reason to speculate. But the pointing out instructions, sometimes it's very memorable because a lama is giving you pointing out instructions. And right there, in that silence, then there's kind of a breakthrough. It can happen that way. It can happen when you're simply sitting out, gazing into the sky, and then click. You know, it's just an analogy, but it's not a bad analogy. Of being in a non-lucid dream, and then something clicks, and everything is different. Because you're now viewing the dream from the perspective of being awake. And it's the same dream, and it's absolutely not the same. Because of your perspective on it. It's something like that's the closest of something we can really imagine. And for those of you who have had lucid dreams, then you can simply remember. What was that transition? It wasn't that the appearances changed. It wasn't the dream change, it was this radical shift on perspective of the dream. Rather than viewing the dream from within the dream, you're viewing the dream from the perspective of being awake. You're awake and dreaming at the same time. Yeah. So that's the microcosm, here's the big one. And so it can happen smoothly. That is, just you're resting there. By smooth, I don't mean just kind of like continuous, but you're just been resting there, and it would seem, then he simply said, then, there was a shift. And so that's what happened. There was a shift, and you'll see what the discontinuity that took place here. Then all my earlier ways of grasping, and that is a very, very broad bandwidth, all my earlier ways of grasping, this bifurcation of subject and object, and all that comes with that of craving, hostility, reification, I am, and subject, object, you and me, self-grasping, and so forth and so on, all of that naturally, it just naturally faded away. He didn't bring out some big antidote and clobber it. It just evaporated. And I came to rest in the great spontaneous vastness of the originally pure ground of being. So you know when he's saying this, every time it refers to the same thing, so I can say it once and then it will cover all the other cases. This originally pure ground of being is simply that primordial non-duality of emptiness and the luminosity of pristine awareness, Dharmadhatu, Dharmakaya, the ground. All things that arose as its creative expressions, all appearances, naturally release themselves in their own expanse. I think that's clear. The essential nature is this originally pure ground of being. Essential nature, Dharmadhatu, together with its creative expressions, the effulgences, all the creative displays of Rigpa, all appearances of samsara and nirvana, together with its creative expressions which are free of modification from this perspective, free of modification, antidote, meditative practice, memory, grasping, and identification, this essential nature is called path pristine awareness. So there's the ground pristine awareness, it's already there, right? It's there, been primordially there. But the path pristine awareness is something that you'll first experience on a Monday, in time, at a place, while receiving pointing out instructions or simply resting in Dzogchen meditation. But something will manifest that you had not experienced before, right? And it is pristine awareness. And this pristine awareness, then you seek to return to and dwell in, sustain, as you learn to dwell in it, supported with your shamatha, vipassana, which will clear all the obstacles away that would prevent you from sustaining that flow, right? As you're sustaining that, and you're in that, you've really earned the ability, you've matured to the ability to rest in that flow of rikpa, then it's that point that you just release all type of activity, all the 9 types of activity, outer, inner, and secret of body, speech, and mind, 3 times 3. You release, and then you simply rest in that. And the point of that is this path, pristine awareness, then it manifests more and more and more clearly. So it's not like you completely got it perfectly the first time, any more than if you're meditating on emptiness. The first time you realize emptiness, that you become an arya, not likely. Because it will still be veiled with subtle concepts, subtle conceptual elaborations. But you are realizing it, but through a veil. And then you return. And of course, then you know. Then over time, with this union of shamatha vipassana, then all the veils evaporate. And on that sutrayana practice of simply focusing, realizing emptiness, then all the veils dissipate. And then you enter into the arya's non-conceptual, unmediated, non-dual realization of emptiness, where the flow of your awareness, this subtle flow of mental consciousness, slips into and merges with your realization of emptiness, with emptiness itself, in an utterly non-dual way. So this would be a parallel to that. But this is a path. Your path means you're moving from here to there. You're moving from an experience that still has some veil, some obscurations, but you have found it, but still veiled, some vestiges of subject, object, and that is being purified. So this is something, the path evolves. So the ground pristine awareness is always there. The path pristine awareness has the appearance from your perspective on the path of evolving, purifying, become distilled, until on this path that your awareness simply is pristine awareness, is Dharmakaya, with no mediation, no duality, no concept, and you become a Vijayadhara. And then you continue practicing from that point. So there's path awareness, and then the fruitional pristine awareness, or resultant pristine awareness, of course, is when you manifestly experience the Dharmakaya in all of its glory, that you are a Buddha, right? So, ground path and fruition. So he's telling us, what was it like when it seemed maybe for the first time he really tasted, experienced this path pristine awareness. At that time, with the absence of mental activity, this is really crucial, activity of mind, activity of which mind? Samsaric mind, conditioned mind, that would include both your coarse mind as well as substrate consciousness. They're both conditioned. So this is mind, coarse and subtle, now devoid of activity. In the complete quieting of mental activity, of course, mental activity means activity that you're involved in. You may still observe events arising, but you're observing them from rikpa. You're not thinking them. You're not identified with them. So they're not activities of the mind, mental events viewed from the perspective of rikpa. So with the absence of mental activity, with the absence of mental activity of a sentient being, there was ultimate reality. As hopes, fears, negation, and affirmation dissolved into absolute space, this is Dharma Dhatu, there was self-emergent primordial consciousness. So self-emergent means not arising independence upon causes and conditions. It's not within the fabric or the framework of time. It's not caused. So it seems to just spontaneously, it's just there. Without seeking, there was, and this term spontaneously comes up so often, without seeking there was the spontaneously actualized essential nature of reality and the mode of being of the great Dharmakaya, free of all extremes, partiality, going and coming. So this hlundup, it's a term that comes up a lot in Dzogchen, hlundup. The most common translation I've seen by other translators is spontaneous presence. It's not wrong. These are fine translators. There are a number of them. They're very, very good. But I think it could be writer. Because flun means spontaneous. But presence would be like yupa. It's just there, presence. But that's not the verb. It's not hlun yut. It's hlun dup. And dup means, it can be, accomplish. Get something done. But my sense of it, I think this is very close. It's spontaneously actualized. Actualized means it's not implicit. It's not hidden. It's actualized. How? Spontaneously. Right? I think it's closer. I think it's actually very close. Spontaneously actualized qualities of enlightenment. Right? They're not simply spontaneously present, because something happened. They're actualized. They weren't actualized, and now they're actualized. And how did that occur? By effort, by cause and effect, linearly, through time? Nope. Just spontaneously, whew, like that. I mean, there's no way to go whew and get it that way. But that's my closest translation. I'm quite content with it. Who knows? Maybe I'll change it later, but not soon. Without seeking, and this is the whole point again, if seeking, you're still seeking from the perspective of a sentient being. You're looking, if you're seeking, you're looking for something you don't have. You haven't found it yet. Which means you're operating out of the mode of being a sentient being, which means you're not resting in Rigpa, which means you are grasping. So this is why there are four knots. There are four knots in this. Not with, that or withouts. You rest without desire, and that would be seeking, no seeking, without effort, without modification, and without doing anything at all. It's all without. But that pretty well covers the bandwidth. And what remains is Rigpa. Okay. This is, again, it just seems so wonderfully timely. It's just like just what the doctor ordered. I'm serious. In this time of modernity, where it's so much about doing and accomplishing and consuming and constructing and building and producing gross domestic product, doing, and if you're not doing something, you're wasting your time. I heard that when I was a kid. Don't just sit there, do something. You know, good Protestant ethic. And of course, we got a lot done. I mean, beautiful technology, art, here we are in the home of the Renaissance and so forth. There's nothing wrong with doing, but maybe we're overdoing, right? And so this is the balance, that sublime balance. It's the yin, the screeching groans of yang are calling out for the sweet melody of yin. And Dzogchen is just, whoa, so yin, and so needed in this time. And it's not a matter of East and West. It's really now just all the way around. That's my sense. I could be wrong, of course. But you'll see that, free of extremes, free of all extremes, free of partiality. So that's why I was going on a little bit this, was it yesterday? Today, whenever, sometime recently, of the pursuit of objectivity. You know, and so I won't say it all over again. But if this is a mode of being that is free of all partiality, then that would be perfect objectivity. Objectivity in the sense of being completely free of subjective bias, because that's exactly partiality. Right? And so it's interesting that this is now not in opposition to, let's say, theism. It's not in opposition to non-theism. It's not in opposition to polytheism. But when we had Galileo, 400 years ago, seeking to rise to a God's eye perspective, the transcendent perspective, free of all distortion, free of all bias, and simply see things as they are. One could interpret this in that way. This is divine. If the word divine means anything in Buddhism, we've just hit it. This is divine. Otherwise, the word has no meaning at all. It is a way of viewing reality, and it is divine, it is transcendent, and it is free of all partiality, and it is to know reality as it is. So my sense is, this is what we've all been seeking, theist, non-theist, atheist, agnostic, and so forth. I think we're all seeking this. We're all seeking a way of knowing that completely satisfies, a quality of being, a well-being that completely satisfies, and that is sustainable. I think we're all seeking it. And in fact, I do believe, of course, that there are many paths to that. And this is one I have a lot of faith in. So, free of partiality, free of coming and free of going, going and coming, like the sun rising in the space of the sky. Free of contamination. I think I'm seeing that right now. The Tuscan sky on a spring morning. Like the sun rising in the space of the sky, free of contamination. Primordial consciousness, pristine awareness, awakened in the nature of its own unmodified, self-emergent ground. In all the appearances of its creative expressions, released themselves without being modified or transformed in any way. So he knows that if you haven't had this experience, no words can convey it. If you have had this experience, you don't need any words. And so what does he do? He goes for metaphor. Goes for metaphor. It's just everywhere. Because you know you can't simply describe it. Like this cup weighs this much, it has this shape, then you can really get a good idea if you're not seeing it. I could really describe this cup so you could get a very good idea of what this cup is like. It's definitely effable and conceivable. We're talking about something here, but that it, by its very nature, is ineffable and inconceivable. But then if you'd still like to be helpful, you know you can't describe it. You know no words will do it, no concepts will wrap themselves around it and capture it, like catching a fish in a net. You'll never catch it in the net of concepts or labels. But you can lead people toward it with the finger pointing to the moon, with metaphor, with analogy. And he's using them again and again and again. It's close as the mind can get. Right? It's not intellectual. It's much more in the realm of intuition, I think. Such natural liberation. In other words, natural means it was already there. You didn't accomplish it. You didn't achieve it. You didn't flex your muscles and go out and conquer it. Such natural liberation is illustrated by the analogy of the non-duality of the sun and its rays. The sun then likened to this original ground of being, and the rays being all the effulgence of the creative displays, creative expressions of pristine awareness. So he gives the ultimate analogy there, or the analogy pertaining to ultimate reality. But then he shows a parallel. And he's saying this right now, because it's very important not to conflate the two. That is, when it says earlier that this pristine awareness is awakened in the nature of its own unmodified self-emergent ground, one can say that ground would have to be Dharma Dhatu, right? And this is primordial consciousness, and it's awakened from the Dharma Dhatu, its self-emergent ground. But now, in the relative context, when you go into deep dreamless sleep, even the substrate consciousness, let alone all the activities of the mind, the physical senses and appearances and all of that, even the substrate consciousness dissolves into the substrate. Right? And when that happens, you're not explicitly aware of anything. Right? In fact, the very nature, this is rather important, the very nature of the alaya, the substrate, is... Anybody remember? Really? Unknowing. Exactly right. Unknowing. Avidya. Unknowing. It's a cloud of unknowing. Not in a mystical sense. It's just unknowing, right? And that's its very nature. And that substrate is exactly that which obscures. It exists. It is a samvritti satya. It's a totally obscuring reality. That would be a very literal translation. Gun zop demba. It is a reality. We shouldn't say that a cup isn't real, it has no reality at all. As if there's only ultimate reality and no relative. There's a cup. If I throw it to you, you can catch it. You know? And so the substrate is a type of reality. We're not speaking of inherent existence, it's something that's there, right? But the nature of this context, this dimension of reality, is samvritti satya, or kunzop dhamma. It's a domain of reality that totally obscures, kunzop, totally obscures a deeper reality that's right there. It's not like it's light years away or hidden in a corner someplace. It's right there, but it's totally obscured by this reality. The substrate is right where the Dharma Dhatu is. It's not even behind it. That would be silly. It doesn't mean anything. But when you're attending to the substrate as a substrate, that will itself obscure the Dharma Dhatu. So the substrate consciousness, the alaya vijnana, when you go into deep, dreamless sleep, or you become comatose, or you faint, you die, it slips into just a state of unknowing. It's ready to be aroused, unlike the unknowing of the not knowing, the absence of knowing of a cell phone. There's no way to arouse it, to wake up. You can't, of course. It has zero. But it slips into that, and then when you are on the course of waking up, then the substrate consciousness emerges from the substrate, and it's explicitly illuminating, right? And so that's where the explicit knowing comes from. It emerges from its ground, the substrate, right? And it illuminates that substrate. And not from over here versus over there. The illumination of the substrate consciousness pervades the substrate that it illuminates. So this is a very early state of awakening, just as in waking up from deep sleep. So it's very good to hear about this, to understand it, such that when you go deeper into practice and you have a sense of this luminous awareness emerging from a ground, you'll know, because you've listened and you've reflected well, is this substrate consciousness emerging from substrate, or is this primordial consciousness emerging from its ground, which is Dharma Dhatu? They're worlds apart. And that's why he's setting these right next to each other. Because both can be understood in terms of that analogy of the sun and its rays. Right? So, what does he say here? The substrate as the essential nature of the mind. Now, this term essential nature, you have to be careful, because it means different things in different contexts. Basically, it can be essential nature as just the unadorned, primal nature. It can also mean its ultimate nature. And you have to know by context, because it's the same word, it's mo. Okay? So the substrate is the essential nature of the mind. Well, the substrate is not rikpa, it's not emptiness, it's not anything ultimate. It's just mind in its primal substrate consciousness. Mind in its primal, relatively unmodified, that it's not being configured as a human, a deva, an animal, and so forth. Is it configured? Yeah, it's in samsara. It's within the nexus of causality. But it hasn't, but not the level of causality that makes it specifically human, male, female, and so forth. So the substrate is the essential nature, the primal nature, I would say here in this context, but this is the correct translation, or a correct translation. The substrate as the essential nature of the mind is darkness like the night. It is an absence of light. It's your mind when it's drawn down to its most primitive level, where the mind is not even explicitly knowing anything at all. Right? One can say, as Penjin Losu Chukyi Gyanzen says, as Jujum Lingba says, the substrate consciousness is the essential nature of the mind, or the conventional nature of the mind. They both say that means the same thing. You've got now down to its bare bones, its brass tacks, its essential features that distinguish it from everything else. But even that substrate consciousness can go even more primal. And that's when it goes, it's almost like an eclipse. Like it gets eclipsed by the darkness of the substrate. And then it's really primal. It's most basic, right? So as the essential nature of the mind, this substrate is darkness like the night. Thoughts. But now look at the parallel between the ultimate Dharma Dhatu, Dharmakaya, and then the effulgence, all the creative displays on this ultimate level, and here on this relative level. From this relative level of the substrate consciousness, thoughts arise, not now, they're not seen as creative displays of rikpa, they arise as, and they are experienced as, dualistic grasping at the apprehender and the apprehended. Welcome to samsara. You never left. But now it's really showing its face, because that's what spontaneously arises out of the substrate consciousness, is dualistic grasping. The sense of I am over here and I am not over there. It's klishta manas at this most primal level, klishta mana, afflictive mentation. You might recall it's substrate consciousness, and then klishta manas, afflictive mentation, this raw, primal, pre-articulate, pre-conceptual sense of I am. And I am not. I am, and over there is the substrate. It's really primal. That's what he's talking, some really primitive, primal grasping of the apprehender and the apprehended. You can see why it's such a big deal then, if one's going to overcome this and overcome this forever, as in reaching and proceeding along the path, to go into, keep on penetrating, come in with that hoe, with that pitchfork, or pickaxe, whatever it is, to break through what is the nature of the mind as agent and fathom that. Because there's the root of the problem, that reification of mind as the agent, or you can impute yourself upon that, then I am the agent. And it's remarkable that people would ask for at least 1,500 years, at least since the time of St. Augustine, does man have free will? Do human have free will? Without penetrating, what is it you're talking about? We're asking whether the agent, a person, they said man back then, let's say human, they're asking whether a human has free will. Assuming, of course, the human is an agent. If a human is not an agent, whether there's free will or not doesn't even come up, right? And so that assumes that you actually know what you're talking about. Do you have free will? That means you must know the referent of the word you. If you don't, why are you talking? Why are you talking on a mound of ignorance? Don't use a word if you don't even know what it means. And what does this word you mean? It's referring to the agent. Do you know what that refers to? Have you checked it out? Do you even exist? Or if you want to slip away the personal pronoun, okay, the mind must be the agent. The mind does all kinds of things. Does the mind exist as an agent? So maybe the reason, at least the primary reason, why there's never been any consensus for 1,500 years of extremely bright people in theology, philosophy, and science, asking this question, do we have free will or not? Why is it that there's never, ever been any consensus and there's no indication we're approaching consensus now? How can you ask a question for 1,500 years by brilliant minds in different fields and none of them ever coming to consensus? The theologians, nope. Philosophers, forget about it. And not even the scientists. No, they have very different views. And they're very smart. Maybe it's because you're asking a question about the agent and you don't even know what the word refers to. Maybe that would be good. And maybe the question will evaporate. Maybe the question will evaporate when you really know what the term mind as agent is referring to. And maybe that's the reason why the question, do human beings have free will, doesn't even come up in Buddhism. If you try to translate that into Tibetan or Sanskrit, you just have to make up something. And then you say it to a Tibetan, they say, what the hell do you mean by that? They say, well, in the West, we've been asking the wrong question for 1,500 years. I thought you might want to know. It doesn't even come up. And in a way, it doesn't even come up because the answer is so obvious. I mean, it's blatantly obvious. Find a person who says, I believe in free will. I really believe in free will. You've got to say, great, exercise it. For the next minute, follow your breath and don't let your mind be distracted. I mean, you know, put up or shut up. If you've got free will, then exercise it over your mind for 1 minute and have no distracted thoughts, maintain an ongoing flow of sheer cognizance of your breathing, and then let me know how that turns out. You know, why? Or somebody insults us. Exercise your free will by not getting upset. Exercise your free will by not feeling sad when you lose something you're attached to. Come on, use it. You got it? If you've got it, flaunt it. If you're free, be free. Ask that of an arhat, and the arhat will say, yep, I'm free. But it took a long time to get here. Oh, no, so. So this is a packed sentence. It is so rich. The substrate is the essential nature of the mind, is darkness like the night. Thoughts arise as dualistic grasping at the apprehender and the apprehended, at subject and object, and the close identification with, this is exactly that, this nyewaralemba, this closely holding to or identifying with, joy and sorrow, felicity and adversity, identifying with, clinging to, grasping to, this is like the reification of a dream, as being truly existent. The analogy is powerful. One more analogy, of course. One more metaphor. It's like this. And we can really understand what that's like because we're awake right now. We're not right now in the midst of an actual dream and reifying it. We've awakened from that and then retrospectively can say, oh, I remember last night I was in a dream and I was not lucid. And yep, I know what you're talking about. Because I reified everything and I was really upset by this and hoping here and anxious here. And then just take that one step further. Right now you're dreaming. From the perspective of one who is awake, right now we are dreaming. From their perspective, from the perspective of Rigpa, this is a dream. It's not like a dream. It is a dream relative to Rigpa. It is not in the essential nature of the sky to change through the course of the day and night. The words sky and space are the same. So you can say space if you like. Space, or the sky, space. It's not in its nature to change through the course of the day and night, but its essential nature. Essential nature. I say space, really. The manifest nature is the sky you see. I can see it's pale blue. I'm looking at the sky. It's pale blue. Is space pale blue? Because we can say the essential nature is space. Space doesn't turn pale blue. That's the essential nature of the sky. The sky is what you see right now. It's pale blue. And in a while, it'll be dark. And then, and so forth and so on. Essential nature, manifest nature. So the essential nature of the sky is not in its nature to change through the course of the day and night, but its manifest nature is affected by the sun, its presence or absence. Likewise, in terms of essential nature. Rigpa. Now essential nature doesn't mean substrate. That's why they, as a translator, as a scholar, you've got to know context. I taught Tibetan for years. I say context is everything. You see the same word in a different context, it means something totally different. Previously, it was very clear when he was referring to the essential nature of the mind being substrate, he certainly was not referring to Rigpa. And now when he's saying the essential nature of the mind does not change, that's not referring to substrate. The substrate is contingent, it's in samsara, it's arising moment to moment to moment. And so, likewise, in terms of its essential nature, the mind does not change. In terms of its, like space, and the mind is like the sky. The manifest nature, of course, is influenced by the presence or absence of the sun. That's a powerful metaphor. Likewise, in terms of essential nature, the mind does not change, but a distinction is made between pristine awareness and the mind. The two are not identical. And the distinction is made, is based on, or the difference between the two, based on the distinction between primordial consciousness and avidya, ignorance, unawareness. The mind is unaware of the nature of reality, and primordial consciousness is aware, rigpa, aware of nature of reality. The ground, now we're back to the ground of being, the ground is the basis from which all of samsara and nirvana emerges, just as a mirror enables all manner of reflections to appear. It's the essential nature of the mind. When he said, all creating sovereign, the mind is the basis of all of samsara and nirvana, now we know exactly what he's talking about, at least conceptually. As a mirror enables all manner of reflections of samsara and nirvana, all manner of appearances to arise. Oh, not so. That's enough. So good. So then we have material on which to reflect, to immerse the mind. Then we come back to meditation, and the meditation will be imbued with, implicitly imbued with whatever understanding comes from listening to teaching, studying the text, reflecting upon the text. That doesn't vanish. It gets into your bloodstream. And then we go into non-meditation, it's there implicitly. And slowly, slowly, that will lead to simply dwelling in the view. And then congratulations. So.